From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I spent 964 days in a Saudi Arabian prison, tortured, sodomized, brutalized by my captors. All of the time was spent in solitary confinement. I was convicted of crimes that I did not commit and sentenced to death by Al-Had. I went through a journey of personal realization in the process before I was finally freed in August of 2003.
Torture and survival in a Saudi prison. Today, a conversation with William Sampson, a Canadian consultant in Saudi Arabia, accused of being a British spy and bombing a British engineer. He's written a new book called Confessions of an Innocent Man. But first, we look at the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, a 24-year-old Arab American convicted of joining al-Qaeda and plotting to assassinate President Bush. He was also held in a Saudi jail for over 2 years, where he says he was tortured. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the trial of Saddam Hussein is resumed amid heavy security inside the Green Zone. On Sunday, Iraqi police arrested 10 Sunni men who were allegedly plotting to assassinate the best-known judge trying Saddam Hussein. Today's proceedings marked his first court appearance since the two lawyers on his defense team were shot dead. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, has joined Hussein's defense team in Baghdad on Sunday. He questioned whether Hussein can get a fair trial in Iraq.
A court can't be a court unless it's absolutely independent. International law and all private and public law in every country requires independence of the judiciary. And that the judges, whoever they are, four we don't know. We haven't seen their faces. We don't know their names. That they be impartial.
That was former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. In other news from Iraq, four humanitarian aid workers from the United States, Canada, and Britain have been kidnapped in Baghdad. Only one of the four has been identified so far, British peace activist and retired professor Norman Kember. Iraq's former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi is claiming the human rights abuses occurring today in Iraq are as bad as they were under Saddam Hussein. In an interview with the Observer newspaper of London, Alawi said, quote, "We're hearing about secret police, secret bunkers where people are being interrogated. A lot of Iraqis are being tortured or killed in the course of interrogations," he said. The British Foreign Office is investigating allegations that private contractors with defense company Aegis have randomly shot at Iraqi cars. According to the Telegraph newspaper, a video recently appeared on a site affiliated with Aegis that contained four clips of an identified gunman shooting at cars in Iraq. In one clip, a Mercedes is fired on at a distance of several hundred yards before it crashes into a civilian taxi. One Iraqi Interior Ministry confirms such shootings occur. He said, "When the security companies kill people, they just drive away and nothing is done. I would say we have had 50 to 60 incidents of this kind." The director general of the Arabic TV network Al Jazeera has demanded Washington respond to reports that President Bush wanted to bomb the network's headquarters in Doha. Last week, the Daily Mirror cited a British memo, secret, revealing that Bush told Tony Blair last year of his desire to bomb the news outlet. The Bush administration has described the Daily Mirror's report as outlandish. Officials at Al Jazeera are now questioning whether the U.S. might have been targeting the network when it bombed its bureaus in Afghanistan in 2001 and Baghdad in 2003. The attack in Baghdad killed Al Jazeera's correspondent, Tariq Ayoub. Ayoub's widow, Dina, said she's now considering suing the U.S. government for her husband's death. She said, quote, "America always claimed it was an accident, but I believe the new revelations prove that claim was false or at least not trustworthy." Meanwhile, in Britain, a ban remains in place on all media outlets from disclosing the contents of the secret memo. But a member of parliament, Boris Johnson, has vowed to publish the memo and risk jail time if anyone leaks him the document. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military has admitted its troops burned the bodies of two Taliban fighters last month. After the troops burned the bodies, a U.S. Army PSYOPs unit was caught on tape broadcasting news of the burning to local residents. U.S. Major General Jason Kamiya said, quote, "Our investigation found there was no intent to desecrate the remains, but only to dispose of them for hygienic reasons." The Army said the soldiers involved will be reprimanded, but no charges will be filed. One of the world's largest conferences ever on global warming opens today in Montreal. But the world's worst polluter, the United States, has decided not to take part. Some 10,000 delegates from around the world are scheduled to attend the UN-sponsored conference to decide the future of the Kyoto Protocol, the international treaty signed by 156 nations to curb greenhouse gases. The Bush administration has opposed the Kyoto Protocol and said individual nations should be able to pursue their own ways to curb emissions. The conference opens just a week after scientists revealed the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is now higher than at any time in the past 650,000 years. Scientists are warning about the impact of the melting ice caps. This is Bob Carell of the American Meteorological Society.
Because as the Arctic ice melts, particularly glaciers and the ice pack of Greenland, it will cause sea level rise. And we expect upwards of a meter of sea level to occur during this coming 100 years. And where you and I are now standing, the beach will be here, just from sea level rise, or maybe even on the berm behind us. So these processes have profound implications for the whole planet. It's not just the loss of polar bear or the difficulties of Inuits losing their lifestyle, but it's profoundly important to the planet at large.
That was Bob Carell of the American Meteorological Society. The climate conference is opening in Montreal at a time of political upheaval in Canada. The House of Commons is expected to vote today to topple Prime Minister Paul Martin's minority government, forcing national elections in January. The Washington Post's reporting the Pentagon's expanded its ability to spy on citizens within the United States. According to the Post, the Bush administration is considering allowing a little-known Pentagon agency called the Counterintelligence Field Activity to investigate certain crimes domestically. The Pentagon's also pushing legislation on Capitol Hill that would create an intelligence exception to the Privacy Act, allowing the FBI and others to share information gathered about U.S. citizens with the Pentagon, CIA, and other intelligence agencies. Kate Martin of the Center for National Security Studies said such an exemption would remove one of the few existing privacy protections against the creation of secret dossiers on Americans by government intelligence agencies. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon said, quote, "We're deputizing the military to spy on law-abiding Americans in America. This is a huge leap without even a congressional hearing," he said. USA Today is reporting over 6,600 people are still reported missing following Hurricane Katrina. Nearly 1,000 of the unaccounted are children. The head of the National Center for Missing Adults says many people are listed as missing because government record-keeping efforts haven't caught up with them in their new locations. But fears are growing that the final death toll could increase significantly from the current toll of 1,300. Meanwhile, the former director of FEMA, Michael Brown, has announced plans to become a government emergency preparedness consultant. Brown was widely criticized for the agency failure to help the people of the Gulf region following the hurricane 12 weeks ago. Backers of California death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams have submitted the signatures of 32,000 people supporting his petition for clemency. Williams is scheduled to be executed December 13th. Tookie Williams is co-founder of the Crip Street Gang. Since his imprisonment, he's become a leading advocate against gang violence and has been nominated for several times for the Nobel Peace Prize. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has agreed to review Williams' case next week. Meanwhile, the United States is about to execute its 1,000th prisoner since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. On average, a prisoner has been executed every 10 days since 1976. 3,400 people remain on death row. In China, at least 68 people have died in a coal mining accident. Another 79 are missing. Meanwhile, China is still recovering from a massive chemical spill that forced the government to shut off all water to a city of nearly 4 million people. About 100 tons of the highly toxic chemical benzene leaked into the Songhua River earlier this month following an explosion at a chemical factory. Over the past 2 weeks, the chemical leak has spread over 50 miles, reaching the city of Harbin. The spill is now threatening Russian cities further downstream. And in Burma, the country's military government has ordered pro-democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi to be held under house arrest for another year. The 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner has spent 10 of the last 15 years under house arrest. The Senegalese government has announced the former president of Chad, Hissène Habré, can stay in the country until the African Union decides his fate. Habré is wanted in Belgium for human rights abuses committed in Chad between 1982 and 1990. Former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet has been put under house arrest for tax fraud and human rights abuses. Pinochet was arrested one day before his 90th birthday. He was accused of overseeing the disappearances of seven people in 1974. And in labor news, the New York Times is reporting union organizers are a step closer to its most successful organizing drive in the South in decades. The Service Employees International Union has helped 5,000 private sector janitors sign petitions supporting unionizing. The janitors are nearly all immigrants and earn an average of just over $100 per week working part-time. And anti-war protesters returned to Crawford, Texas last week, where President Bush was celebrating Thanksgiving. On Wednesday, about a dozen protesters, including Daniel Ellsberg, were arrested. They were charged with violating new rules put in place after thousands gathered for a month-long vigil in August organized by Cindy Sheehan, whose son died in Iraq. This is Cindy Sheehan.
We're here to say that the killing has to stop, that we're not going to justify any more killing on our losses. And we're not going away. We don't hate anybody. We just want people to be held accountable. And just because someone's president of the United States, it doesn't guarantee them immunity from accountability.
That was Cindy Sheehan. Her son, Casey, died in Iraq on April 4th, 2004, in Sadr City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A 24-year-old Arab American was convicted Tuesday of joining al-Qaeda and plotting to assassinate President Bush. Houston native Ahmed Omar Abu Ali was tried after spending nearly 2 years in a Saudi Arabian prison where he says he was tortured into making a confession. Two doctors who examined him corroborated his claim. Abu Ali moved to Saudi Arabia to study Islam in the year 2000. He was arrested 3 years later while taking final exams at the Islamic University of Medina. He'll be sentenced February 17th. He faces life in prison. We're joined now on the line by Ahmed Omar Abu Ali's attorney, Ashraf Noubani. He's a Virginia-based attorney and managing partner of the Noubani Law Firm. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to the conviction of your client?
Well, obviously, the jury has spoken, but it's not over. We have planned to appeal. The appeal will be done after the sentencing in February. We believe that it's unfortunate that the judicial system and the justice system hasn't worked when it comes to these types of cases, but certainly in the case of Ahmed, who was tortured and held by a foreign country and then rendered back to the United States, only to face these criminal charges.
Can you talk about the defense of your client and also your ultimate response to the conviction? The Washington Post today has an editorial, "Belated Justice for a Terrorist."
Actually, I didn't see the I didn't see that, but it's just unfortunate that we have a situation again, as I said, that you have someone who was held in solitary confinement for 20 months in Saudi Arabia. We were unable to bring evidence of the Saudi system, the Saudi judicial system there, and the methods of interrogation other than through a cross-examination of what's called the Saudi Mabahith, the Secret Service in Saudi Arabia, through depositions that were held there and were under a protective order for many months before the actual trial. Belated justice in the sense that we didn't have the opportunity to show that he had been tortured beyond allowing Ahmed to testify. There was no way to go to Saudi Arabia to uncover the methods of abuse that is applied by the Saudi government in these types of cases on its own citizens and citizens abroad, and to come back after 2 years and, you know, charge someone with conspiracy, which even the indictment and the government agrees that the conspiracy, in, for example, to assassinate the president, never went beyond the talking stage. The person who Ahmed was alleged to have discussed the assassination of the president has been dead for over a year, and therefore, the person is no longer living, and therefore, it was just unbearable to see 12 jurors to decide that someone is guilty of these crimes.
I wanted to read you, Ashraf Noubani, from the Washington Post piece that you haven't gotten a chance to see yet. It says that Abu Ali's family alleged on behalf of the U.S. government he was held for the better part of 2 years without charge or access to counsel. When his parents brought suit in this country, the government fought the lawsuit not only with secret evidence but with a secret legal theory. It then brought him home and charged him with plotting to kill President Bush and conduct major terrorist operations. Mr. Abu Ali, in turn, claimed he'd been tortured and had confessed falsely under duress, an allegation that, given Saudi Arabia's human rights record, was plausible. Sorting out the question of his guilt and the linked question of his treatment seemed a tall order indeed. Last week, a jury in federal court in Alexandria convicted Mr. Abu Ali on all charges against him. The trial, which was conducted remarkably smoothly, answered a lot of troubling questions the case posed. It now appears, for example, Mr. Abu Ali was not arrested at the behest of American authorities, but on the initiative of Saudi authorities investigating terrorism in their own country. After a lengthy set of hearings on Abu Ali's allegations of torture, the U.S. District Judge Gerald Bruce Lee produced a detailed opinion rejecting them and holding that Mr. Abu Ali's incriminating statements about his plans and activities were voluntary and therefore admissible as evidence against him. The jury evidently agreed. The trial had certain peculiarities. Key witnesses testified from Saudi Arabia by video conference, but in the main, the result is an outcome that has happened too infrequently in the war on terrorism, a conviction in a major case following the regular rules. Your response?
Well, I think that this is the tragedy of this case. Certainly, there hasn't been a case since September 11th that these terrorism cases have turned out what they were touted to be by the government or the administration. And Ahmed Abadi's case is no different. I think that there was a lot of failures in the justice system in this case. One is that the judge heard Ahmed testify. Everyone in the courtroom and the public heard that testimony. There wasn't an issue about his credibility as to what happened. I believe that the judge did not want to be in a position where he would let the quote-unquote terrorist go by suppressing the evidence against him. You have to understand that the evidence that was presented by the prosecution was basically his statements, and the government's position, obviously, would that he wasn't tortured. But the case shouldn't have gone to the jury in the first place. As far as, you know, as I said, the jury has spoken. But again, it's impossible, almost impossible, and there are flukes, but it's almost impossible to receive a fair trial in the United States after September 11th, but certainly in the Eastern District of Virginia, where the jury pool is devoid of minorities and people who share a diverse background.
Will you be appealing on those grounds?
Well, the judge's finding is a credibility issue, which there is no appeal. He would have to have been wrong on the law. The joint venture issue that was alluded to in the Post article is an issue that we weren't able to flesh out. And the problem with that was that the government had kept a lot of the material away from the defense team throughout the trial. I had applied for a security clearance that was denied by the government, and no specific reason was given. And it was too late for the rest of the team to apply for their own security clearances, and we had to bring in counsel that was cleared. The paperwork the documents that were turned over that were unclassified showed that Ahmed was being held at some point at the behest of the United States. In fact, it was the CIA asked that he be held, and at one point there's a communication that stated that he should no longer be held at the behest of the United States. We don't have the smoking gun. We believe that if that existed, it was certainly destroyed and would not be available to us. But it doesn't mean that there wasn't a joint venture here. It's just that the judge didn't buy that argument, and therefore we couldn't go on that basis.
And by joint venture, you mean the U.S. and Saudi Arabia,
yes,
cooperating and holding Ahmed Omar Abu Ali?
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Ashraf Noubani, the lawyer for the Arab American student who was just convicted. He'll be sentenced in February. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we return, we'll be joined by a Canadian-British consultant who went to Saudi Arabia, was arrested on several charges, was held for 2.5 years, and has written a book about his torture and survival in a Saudi prison. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, and college radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations. And we're broadcasting on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to another Westerner who also says he was tortured into confessing to a crime he says he didn't commit while he was in a Saudi prison. 5 years ago this month, car bombings in Saudi Arabia killed 2 British nationals and wounded 2 others. Most of the targeted were working as foreign engineers in Saudi Arabia. The bombing set off another nightmare for several of their colleagues who were accused by the Saudi government of carrying out the attacks. One of them was William Sampson. Sampson's a Canadian citizen working as a consultant in the Saudi Arabian pharmaceutical industry. Within weeks of the bombings, he was imprisoned, along with 7 others, and placed in solitary confinement. William Sampson remained in jail for over 2.5 years, where he says he was tortured, beaten, sodomized. Medical tests subsequently backed up his claims. In February 2001, after weeks of torture, Sampson appeared on Saudi Arabian television and confessed to the bombings. He later claimed he'd endured torture so painful in prior weeks, he'd begged his captors to let him confess. The televised confession elicited a worldwide campaign to secure his release. Sampson's case was taken up by the Association in Defense of the Wrongfully Convicted and championed by prominent advocates such as the late attorney Johnny Cochran and wrongfully imprisoned former boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter. Under mounting international pressure, the Saudi government granted him clemency. In August 2003, Sampson and 5 others were set free. Since his release, Sampson has initiated legal proceedings against the Saudi government. He's also written a book about his ordeal. It's called Confessions of an Innocent Man, Torture and Survival in a Saudi Prison. William Sampson joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about the day you were arrested.
Well, it started off as a normal but stressful day. I got up in the morning, made myself coffee, ran out of my house, late as always.
Why were you in Saudi Arabia?
I was in Saudi Arabia working as a consultant for the Saudi Industrial Development Fund, which is a government development bank. And I was there as a marketing consultant reviewing project proposals by startup industry in Saudi Arabia.
How long had you been there?
About 2.5 years at the time of my arrest. And as I said, I ran out the front door, saw that there was a flat tire on my car, turned to get a taxi, and I saw another car pull up and almost run me over. A couple of individuals jumped out of it, stripped my possessions off me. A third got out of the car, waved a gun at me, and the next thing I knew, I was on my way to a Saudi Arabian prison.
And then what happened?
Well, when I first arrived at the prison, I was chained to the door of my cell, chained upright in the door of my cell, and assigned an initial number. I think it was 23. Or 26 at the time, and I stood in that position for about an hour or so before I was taken up for my first interrogation session. And during that session, I was beaten and punched, and asked various questions about what I'd been doing in the preceding weeks, specifically around about the times of two bombings, one that had occurred on November the 17th, one that had occurred on November the 22nd of 2000. And also about a bombing that had occurred only 2 days previously on December the 15th of 2000. As I said, I answered those questions in between.
These were all bombings of cars?
These were all bombings. Yes, the first bombing that occurred on November the 17th was on the car of a British national called Christopher Rodway, which killed Christopher Rodway and injured his wife.
Did you know him?
I didn't know him, but I had a friend who knew him who worked in the same department at the military hospital in Riyadh. On the night of the second bombing, November 22nd, a car with four British expatriates, well, three British and one Irish expatriate, were driving on their way to a party at one of the sort of Western residential compounds in Riyadh. And a friend of mine was in the car immediately behind them, following them to that party. The bomb went off, and that one injured the occupants and almost but not quite killed, severely injured, a chap called Mark Payne. If my friend Raf Skevens, who was following the vehicle, hadn't been there, the severely injured party, Mark Payne, would possibly have bled to death. Raf, being a trauma nurse, actually stopped and rendered first aid assistance until the emergency services were actually able to take up the slack. For his pains, Raf was subsequently arrested and tortured, much as I was.
For how long?
Oh, he was in prison. He was in prison for a week longer than myself. So I was in for 964 days. He was in for 971.
And he had already been arrested at the time of your arrest?
Yes, he would have been arrested about a week before me. And what had happened was, after the second bombing had gone off, all the witnesses to the bombing were questioned by the police, and they were asked lots of odd questions, like all the names of people they knew and all the relationships with all the other Westerners. And Raf was the last of them to actually be questioned. And during his initial questioning sessions, they kept making statements at him that they knew he was the bomber. But they released him. So he just assumed, and we all assumed, that those were just sort of threats to unsettle him. The next thing happened was that about a week before my arrest, about December the 10th, he just disappeared. I had phoned. I had been intending to actually meet him that day. I phoned him from my work just before leaving work, and just by chance got him on his cell phone. At the time, his villa was being searched by the secret police, and he was being arrested. And from that moment on, for the next week, I spent my time chasing around all the contacts I had at various police stations, trying to find out where he might be, until I eventually got told to back off, because where he was somewhere I wasn't going to find. So when that car pulled up, about 7 days after he disappeared, when that car pulled up in front of me, I knew they were coming for me, because it was just standard. I was a friend of Raf's. They had arrested Raf Skevens. We were going to pin the bombing on him, at least the second bombing on him. I was a friend of Raf's. I was also known to the secret police out there, or to the intelligence, Ministry of Interior Intelligence people, because I had been involved in assisting a number of Westerners on different occasions with difficulties they had at police stations over infringements of alcohol laws or socializing laws that they have in Saudi Arabia. It is, for example, illegal for the conversation that is taking place to happen out there. I'm not married to you. You're not related to me. I can't be technically in your presence socially, and I can be arrested for that, and so can you. And these types of minor infringements, Alexander Mitchell and myself had been involved in smoothing over the process at the police station so that the paperwork didn't get too sticky for most people. With that on our background, we obviously seemed to fit the frame. And on December the 17th, I disappeared. As I found myself in this police cell, and the beating started from the very, very start. Within a couple of days, the beatings had progressed from just punching, kicking, being thrown around the room, having my testicles stood on, to being laying down on the floor in a hog-tied position, hands shackled behind my back and attached to my ankles, and then beaten over the soles of the feet. And this then followed on to something called falanga, where you're strapped over a metal bar and hung upside down off the floor so that your feet and buttocks are prominently exposed, and then you're beaten across the soles of the feet, across the buttocks, and then every once in a while I'd have a quick shot into my scrotum. The damage that was done there, I mean, within a few days of that, I literally had testicles the size of oranges. And my feet were swollen, discolored. I was just a tapestry of bruises.
Who was doing this to you?
Oh, my Saudi Arabian interrogators, two individuals, Ibrahim al-Dali and Khalid al-Salah principally. There was, in those initial days, a third individual who was torturing me, but I was never able to determine his name. And that, as I said, went on until after about 6.5 days, I broke and I told them what they wanted to hear. But everything that
what
they wanted me to confess to was the car bombing that killed Christopher Rodway. They initially started off accusing me of the three car bombings, the ones on the 17th, the 22nd of November, and then the one on December the 15th. They couldn't fit the one on December the 15th to me because it would have been impossible for me to be in Riyadh and in Dammam, 3.5 hours drive away. I'm back in Riyadh again. I couldn't, the timings of it just wouldn't work for me actually being up there to be fitted for that one. So they backed off on that and then just focused in the initial phase on the first car bombing, the one that killed Christopher Rodway. You know, there's obviously, you're obviously going to resist confessing to something which you know in Saudi Arabia carries the death penalty, which is murder. But all the while that they're actually interrogating me, they're actually giving me the information that they want me to confess to. They're not asking me any direct questions about my activities. They're telling me where I went, what I did, who I saw, how I did it. And they're repeating this over and over again and telling me that you're going to confess and continuing the beatings. And then eventually I just couldn't take any more pain and I began to tell them what they told me.
When did they videotape your confession?
That was about 6.5 weeks in. Now, I had, as I said, that initial period of about 11 days of imprisonment, my first 11 days of imprisonment in one of their interrogation centers where I was tortured, was broken to confess to confess to, one, committing the bombings that killed Christopher Rodway, and two, to being a British spy, doing it at the behest of the British government, and which was, to my mind, absolutely crazy. I mean, if there's ever a government that's helped keep the al-Sauds in power, it's the British government. And yet here I was confessing to being a spy and trying to destabilize that self-same government. But that's what they wanted me to confess to. I got transferred to another prison, to their main political prison in Al-Hayer, where I was tortured over another about 14 or so days. I then had about 2 weeks off after that, and I had a visit with my embassy. But unlike the sort of norm in those situations, which is that you have free and unhindered access to your diplomats and that you have a private conversation with them, the two people that were torturing me were in the room during the entire conversation, and I was briefed by them before I went into
Khalid and Ibrahim.
I was briefed by them before I went in there as to what would happen to me if I told them, my embassy officials, anything of what had happened to me. A couple of days after
Didn't your embassy officials insist that they leave?
Never.
What did the Canadian government do for you?
Told me that I was guilty to my face. That's about all that they did for me, and they also told my father the same thing. That was the full extent of it. And yet I know that the Canadian government has never been provided with any forensic evidence that would confirm my guilt. They have never been given a sight of the confessions I signed. And I signed more than 20 different books of confessions, each one variations on a theme, and each one almost contradictory of the others because they're refining the story as they went along.
You mean that when they weren't satisfied with the first,
they'd come back after a couple of hours of giving me a break, start beating the hell out of me again, and then start on a new
confession. Did they speak English when you...
My interrogator, one of my interrogators, Khalid, he was the English speaker there, and he did all the English work, so to speak, of the interrogation sessions. Ibrahim focused on asking questions in Arabic, and he was the main swinger of the baton, as I would say. He was the one who curated, did most of the physical brutality during the interrogations. But
how did they do the videotape confession?
Oh, it's relatively simple. It was done at Al-Haya prison up in the interrogation suites, and they'd taken one of the rooms and sort of made it up into, cleaned it up a little bit and made it look a bit more presentable, put a rather fancy desk in there and a board and the rest, and had basically a small studio set up in one corner. And we were brought in, sat down, and basically told to read off a script. Now, before the confessions, before I was let in to do the confession, I was taken into one of the other interrogation rooms and told that I was being made. I was going to make a video, which was to be shown to members of the royal family, so they didn't have to come down to the prison to see me testify to them directly. I knew that that was the biggest load of nonsense I'd ever heard. I knew that they were taping this for general broadcast, but I was hardly in a position to challenge them on the veracity of their statements. So they began telling me what I had to say, and I persuaded my captors that I should be allowed to write a script for it, and which I then tried to make my language as stilted and odd as possible, because I would have had difficulty actually being that stilted naturally for some reason. Went in and did various takes after take after take of the video confession, going over and over, sometimes with the script in front of me, sometimes without it in front of me, sometimes indicating at the wall chart that had been with the movements that I was supposed to have taken part in on the night of the bombings. And that went fine. And then a couple of days after that, they came up and they wanted now, they said, oh, we have to do some more videoing for the royal family. And once again, I knew it was a load of nonsense. But this time, the videos contained not the mechanics of the bombing, which is what the first ones were, but the second video session was all about why we did it and why I was a spy for the British government, what I hoped to achieve and in setting off bombs which were ostensibly against Western targets within Saudi Arabia. And from that, they made what you've seen out on that which was broadcast on Saudi Arabian television.
William Sanson, I want to play an audio excerpt of that so-called confession.
I admit and acknowledge that I have participated with Mr. Alexander Mitchell in setting up an explosive device on the vehicle belonging to Mr. Christopher Rodway, a British national. I detonated the explosive device using a remote control switch. Mr. Mitchell and I then headed south towards Al Jazeera. 2 days later, Mr. Mitchell ordered me to set up a second explosion with the participation of Mr. Ralph Scovins, a Belgian national.
That was William Sampson in 2001, after how many weeks of imprisonment and torture?
That would have been, as I said, 6 weeks, 2 days, 6 weeks, 3 days, when that video was made. It wasn't broadcast till the February the 5th, oddly enough, my father's 70th birthday.
And the response of people around the world?
Those who knew me did not believe that I had done those crimes, and they believed that I had been forced to make those confessions. I am certain that there may have been other people out there who would think, well, he's confessing, he must have done it. But then they don't know the background behind those tapes and they aren't experienced enough to analyze that video performance. I've certainly seen a number of reports from psychologists who reviewed it, and they have basically said whoever was making those statements had been coerced into them. And they said that about my statements, they said about that about those of all the detainees that were forced to do the same thing.
When did your father first get to see you?
He didn't get to see me until the summer. Well, he first got to see me on February the 5th on his birthday, as I said, when he saw those videos. But he didn't see me personally until in June of 2001. He came out to Saudi Arabia on a visit. And that was part and parcel of all I can think of is a propaganda exercise. I'd had a couple of heart attacks as a result of the torture.
How old are you?
47. Well, 46, going on 47. And at the time that I had the heart attacks, that would have been 2001, I'd have been 42.
And did you have a history in your family of heart trouble?
Yeah, when they're about 80 years old. Most of my family die of heart disease at some stage, usually some stage between about... Let's see, my Uncle Bill was one of the younger ones. He died at 78, and he was a lifelong smoker as well. Most of the rest of them died in their mid-80s and up to their 90s. So, yes, we have heart disease in the family, but it doesn't tend to take us out until we're of a ripe old age, as is most cases with most families. So I wasn't a prime candidate for heart disease at that age. I'd have been 42. Although my cardiologist that I've been seeing in London has said to me that sleep deprivation, which I had been subjected to quite prolonged periods of, was probably the single most important factor in causing the heart condition.
We're talking to William Sampson, who was imprisoned by the Saudi regime for over 2.5 years and has written a book that is brand new, just out, Confessions of an Innocent Man, Torture and Survival in a Saudi Prison. He was released in 2003. Can you talk about your first hallucination?
Well, that happened about 5 days into my imprisonment, and I hadn't had, as I said, I was under a regime of sleep deprivation, chained to my door so I couldn't sit down and I couldn't sleep. And all I can remember was seeing something moving on the wall. And I don't like spiders, and I have never liked spiders. And what I thought was moving on the wall was a spider, and within a few minutes I had a prison cell full of spiders. The sort of, how does one put it, the sort of things you might see in some ridiculous horror film or at the New York Zoo or something like that, the sort of Amazonian bird-eating spiders, the things that are about the size of your hand. And I saw these walking all around my prison cell. And then I could feel the sensation of something creeping over my body, my entire skin tingling with it. And I spent my time in the cell. One part of me was battling with the fact that these were illusions. This was a hallucination. The other part of it thought it was completely real. And it was, you know, it drives you to the edge. That was driving me at that time to the edge of sanity.
How long hadn't you slept for?
By that stage, 5 days, a full 5 days. Well, and I wouldn't sleep until I'd been had gone through a total of 11 days of sleep deprivation on that first session. Then the next session of sleep deprivation was 14 days. I had the hallucinations again, but I'd learned to cope with them better. And my third period of sleep deprivation, which led to my heart attack, was for 20 days.
We're going to come back to our discussion with William Sampson, find out about his meetings with his father, what the Canadian and British governments were doing, what the Saudi regime was saying, how he finally got out. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Our guest is William Sampson, author of Confessions of an Innocent Man. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Our guest is William Sampson, a Canadian citizen, also a British citizen, held in a Saudi jail for close to 3 years. has written a book, Confessions of an Innocent Man, Torture and Survival in a Saudi Prison. So you're talking about your time in prison. They tortured you, you say. Raped you?
Yes.
Who?
Khalid and a chap I call the Spiv. I never had his name. I never knew what his name was. But about day nine, after I'd confessed to being a bomber, but before I confessed to being a spy, they'd begun to soften me up again with demands to confess to being a spy. And one day, as I said, on day nine, I was led into the office. The usual participants, Khalid and Ibrahim, weren't there, and I was only in the company of the Spiv, who had always...
You nicknamed him that.
I nicknamed him that. I had no other name for him, so I just gave him a nickname because of what he reminded me of. He had this very thin little mustache that sort of reminded me of the... of a particular period of fashion for that sort of thing back in the 1940s, worn by a sort of...
Is this how you kept your sanity?
By these sort of references and these sort of rude remarks about my captors under my breath, yes. That was one of the methods, one of the tactics that I used. Dehumanizing them to a certain extent in the way that they were trying to dehumanize me, I guess, would be one way of putting it. But... all throughout the interrogation, I'd always found him a bit strange or a bit unsettling because he had been using sort of almost sexual intimidation as part of his interrogation strategy. But rather than it just seemed to be sexual intimidation, there did actually seem to be some real sexual overture in it. And I then discovered that there was, and because I was taken across the hall from where from the interrogation office into the room where I'd normally been beaten, and there I was raped by him, and then I was raped by Khalid. And that seems to have been done with everyone's foreknowledge, because the next day he repeated the process and got into an argument with Khalid about it. So obviously, day nine I was supposed to have been raped, but day ten I wasn't supposed to have been.
How did you keep your sanity?
It was very, very hard to. I think at the time of the rape on day nine, I came as close to losing sanity, of coming to a complete mental and emotional breakdown, as I was ever likely to. And I just, as I said, had a realization. I mean, in describing it, it takes longer than the actual realization itself. The realization came in a split second. A piece of poetry filtered into my mind from my childhood, from my adolescence, and I had this realization that nothing they could do to me, no matter what pain they inflicted upon me, could be any worse than had already happened, and I'd survived that. And I was still, there was still some small part of me intact that I could find and retreat into. And at that moment, I knew I could endure, and I knew that I could survive. And that was it. From that point onwards, I was on my way back. I wasn't going to be able to resist the torture and not give them what they wanted, but I could survive emotionally intact nonetheless.
When you see the pictures at Abu Ghraib, the reports of what's happened at Guantanamo, what is your response?
It's damned barbaric. It's that simple. It is morally wrong. There is no other way of describing it. And not only is it morally wrong, it's a political mistake. And it is also a mistake in terms of intelligence gathering. Politically, it's a mistake because all it is going to do is continue to store up ill will towards the United States and towards the Western countries that are allies of the United States in various regions around the world. And that is not going to make anyone any safer, regardless of the information that they garner from the techniques that they apply in places like Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. But worse still is the fact that in doing that, the information that they gather is oftentimes, most of the time, it is bad information, bad intelligence.
As in your case, what you confess to?
I can point to at least nine confessions that I know of in Saudi Arabia, including my own, that were false. Myself and my fellow detainees that were held in Riyadh. But I can also point to false confessions of British nationals held in Guantanamo, such as the Tipton Three. Three British nationals of Pakistani ethnic origin who were released from Guantanamo, although they had confessed to being al-Qaeda operatives that had been in Tora Bora with Osama bin Laden. Unfortunately, during the timings of their supposed confessions extracted from them in Guantanamo, British intelligence actually discovered CCTV footage of them being at their workplace in Tipton, Yorkshire, at the Currys electrical goods store. That's the product of coercive, what the people in Guantanamo are trying to define as coercive interrogation, but which does conform to torture under the United Nations Convention Against Torture. That's what you get from it. You get bad information that has the wrong people in prison and has your intelligence operatives following bad leads. It does not make you safer. It does not protect you as a society.
The Bush administration seeking a CIA exemption from torture, cruel and human degrading punishment.
I'm sure Adolf Hitler did the same thing in 1939. It's as simple as that in my mind. It is, you know, it's wrong. And you should be, anybody who indulges in an act of torture should be liable for prosecution. That's it.
No
exemptions because you're working for a government. No exemptions because you're claiming right on your side. It is morally wrong, and it is a bad thing to do. It's bad, as I said, morally, it is bad politically, and it's bad in terms of intelligence, and you should be held accountable for doing it.
Are you suing your captors?
Yes, in a British courtroom, because I have no chance of redress in Saudi Arabia, and little chance in Britain, but at least a little bit more.
How are you going about this? Are you suing the Saudi regime itself?
No, we're suing the individuals because we have something in Britain called the State Immunity Act 1978, which prevents us from suing the state. So what my lawyers, Jeffrey Byman, quite intelligently decided to do, because he's been involved in attempting to overturn state immunity in a previous case and wasn't successful. So in our case, we decided to pursue the individuals, but not just the individuals who tortured us, but also the individuals who we could name who colluded in the torture or who ordered the tortures. So we're suing Khalid and Ibrahim because we can name them and they are the torturers. We're suing Mohammed Saeed, who was the governor of the prison, who ensured that we were prepared for torture when he should have prevented it, as we were his responsibility. And we're suing Prince Naif because he was the one who has constructed a regime in which torture is legitimized as a normal state tool when that is not supposed to be the case.
Did the British or Canadian government ever contest that torture went on in Saudi Arabia?
Against us, no, they never did. They have actually denied it, and they have been silent about that. Privately, they have sort of... Privately, the British government, in example, has sort of said that they believe that we are innocent and that they believe that we were tortured. The British government has actually got medical reports from a number of us who've had medical investigations that prove torture.
You and?
Myself, Alexander Mitchell, Les Walker, James Cottle, Peter Brandon.
These are all men who were picked up for these bombings?
All men picked up for these bombings. Ron Jones. That's another one. There's a total of 6 Britons, I believe, who've been to the Parker Institute and had the medical examinations done there and have confirmatory evidence that has been that can stand up in court from a medical technique that has been peer-reviewed in the scientific literature.
The Canadian embassy officials who came to see you, did they know you were being tortured at the time?
No, they did not. They were working under... It would seem that they were working under the assumption that I wasn't being tortured, or they certainly didn't want to know if I was.
Could you convey it to them in your meetings?
The answer to that is not really. I should have conveyed it to them in my meetings, but the problem for me was that all of my meetings that were conducted with the Canadian embassy officials were done in the presence of the 2 men that tortured me. Although 1 or 2 of the meetings were done in just the presence of one of the ones who tortured me, it was normal that somebody who had tortured me was there at the meetings with the embassy
officials. You were afraid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first couple of meetings, before in just about every embassy meeting I had, I would be taken before Khalid and Ibrahim prior to the meeting and told what I could and could not say and threatened. And the result is that when I had the first meeting at about week 6, I had just come through 28 days of extreme brutality during which I had been sodomized. I was not in a frame of mind that had enough courage to actually turn around and say that I'd been tortured. I eventually did so when I became angry enough to do it, but that took a while before that happened.
Can you explain how you communicated with your father when he came to visit you in code?
Well, the simple fact was is that my father knew my background better than anyone else, and I reckoned that if I said something to him which contained deliberate mistakes at the beginning, he would get that I was trying to say something to him. He would understand that there was, you know, I don't recognize what he's saying now, and this must be a deliberate mistake. Maybe there's something in what he's going to say.
Or he'd think you were just crazy.
No. I knew my father better than that, and he knew me better than that. And so I delivered him a message about, you know, tell the boys in St. Stephen's, well, I've never been to a school called St. Stephen's and all the academic institutions I've attended in my life, that it's just like being back in boarding school, and I've never been in a boarding school. I was educated in a private school, but I was not a resident of that school. That it's just like being back in a boarding school. The mattresses are lumpy, the food is lousy, and there's plenty of attention from Dr. Birching. That was, again, a sort of semi-coded reference again to the practice of birching, the medieval practice of birching in the United Kingdom, which is being beaten with a stick, all right, which my father understood. I also pointed out to him that he should remember me to my friends in Rosyth, which is a British naval dockyard, which I've never been to and which I don't have any friends in, and my father would know that.
And why did you say that?
Because of the fact I said, remember my friends in Rosyth, tell them it's just like being back in the Navy. It's just like being in the Navy. There's no rum, but there's plenty of the other two. And that's a response to this sort of criticism of the Royal Navy that it was nothing but rum, sodomy, and the lash. By saying that there's no rum, but there's plenty of the other two, he would understand the other two meant sodomy and the lash. And he picked up on both of those things. And he informed the embassy, I believe my son is being beaten, brutalized. And they were in denial about it. So much in denial about it that they actually told him during one of his visits that I was guilty of the crimes I'd committed. Yet they had, as I said, never seen any evidence of that.
How did you get out?
Well, we were released in August of 2003, but how, and lots of things were talked about, how, you know, back-channel diplomacy and building bridges, but what really got us out was a plain and simple, an illegal hostage exchange. We were exchanged for 5 Saudi Arabians detained in Guantanamo as al-Qaeda operatives. Now, whether or not these people were genuine al-Qaeda operatives, I cannot say. They could have been innocent just as we were, or they could have been guilty. In either case, what was then conducted was something which was completely and utterly illegal. You had at least what would have been 8 innocent men, 8-9 innocent men in Riyadh, being bartered for 5 people of a status I can't comment on one way or another. And I haven't heard anywhere that that sort of thing is legal. As a matter of fact, I keep hearing countries like Britain and the United States saying they don't negotiate over in hostage-taking situations. Well, what were they doing in our case? That all started around about October 2002 and was finalized sometime in February. The process was speeded up because I think as a means of speeding the process up and reaching a final agreement on it, the Saudi Arabian Appeal Court finally handed down their final verdict on myself and Alexander Mitchell and sentenced us to death in February of 2003. We'd already been sentenced to death, but we'd undergone a second set of appeals, and that was finally handed down in around about January, February of 2003. And then the process of finalizing the negotiations for our release was done. The Saudis were supposed to be released in May 2005. They were. We were supposed to go home either at the end of May or the beginning of June, and we didn't. And there then followed some further arm twisting.
They were released in 2005?
2003, pardon.
Oh, 2003.
2003, sorry. And as I said, we were supposed to be released within a couple of weeks of them. That didn't happen. And there were various questions raised about this, particularly by the Belgians, who were taking a back seat in the negotiations, because the negotiations centered around, as far as I've been made aware, the British, American, and Saudi Arabian governments were involved in this. The Canadian and the Belgian governments, who had nationals involved, were on the sidelines. They were informed, but they were not involved.
We have to go for 10 seconds. Your life right now, what are you doing?
Basically, I'm promoting the book, obviously. I've been doing a lot of work with human rights organizations over the last couple of years, and I'm getting ready to go back to law school.
William Sampson, I want to thank you for being with us. He tells the story of his imprisonment in a Saudi jail in his book, Confessions of an Innocent Man, Torture and Survival in a Saudi Prison. That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to the website, see video, audio. We podcast there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. Welcome back to Uri Galad. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.